Whales haven't had to evolve anything new. They just had to emphasize or refashion existing traits. Another peculiarity is the fact that river dolphins have returned to the same freshwater systems that their ancestors inhabited some 50 million years ago, during the time of Pakicetus. Parsing the question of how whales ended up adapted for life in freshwater leads back, in the end, to a sole specimen. To gain an understanding of any species or lineage, scientists must first start with such an individual. These single specimens are called types, and they are the ne plus ultra, primary reference material, the specimens to which any other possible specimen from that species must be compared. More practically, type specimens need to be held in the custody of a museum, where any scientist can go see them, study them, measure them, and, in some cases, even destructively sample them. Types matter for species that have gone extinct because they are the touchstones for any kind of biological question. Once the last individual has died, there's no way to increase the sample size, measure changes that happen with age, or study the variation in a trait over generations, the fuel of evolution. The last known individual Yangtze River dolphin, Lipodes vexillifer, died in 2002 in captivity. No one has seen or heard a Yangtze River dolphin since. The last survey in 2006 failed to find any. The type specimen of the Yangtze River dolphin rests in a case in the west wing of the research collections at my museum, but it was collected over 100 years ago by Charles Macaulay Hoy, a teenage hunter hired by the Smithsonian to collect bird and mammal specimens in the Hunan Valley of China. Like many natural history museums eager to expand their collections from remote parts of the world, the Smithsonian hired locals with a particular blend of wherewithal and ambition. As the youngest son of missionaries, Hoy knew the hinterlands of the Chinese countryside. He had recognized that there were two different kinds of cetacean species in the lake that flowed off the Yangtze River. The Baji, the common Mandarin name for Lipodes, and a smaller, finless porpoise, which Hoy called the black species, now known by the scientific name of Neophocaena Asia orientalis. It teeters on the brink for reasons that similarly drove the Baji to extinction. If we want to know what the Baji was like before it disappeared, how it moved, what it ate, where it went to breed, before the handful of surviving members of the species were transferred to concrete aquariums, we can read Hoy's account, beginning on a winter's day in 1916, when he and his boat companions on a duck hunt came across a school of Baji, a species he had long desired to procure. The only black and white photograph of the day shows Hoy wearing a flat expression under the brim of his broad hat, suppressed pride, or perhaps a studied pose, kneeling with rifle in hand behind the 300-pound carcass of the future-type specimen, its mouth propped open by a stick. His account tells us that they swam in pods of 10 to 15 individuals, leaving the water muddy from stirring up the lake bottom to feed on catfish, which Hoy found in the type specimen's stomach. Hoy's report tells us that when the lake's water level rose in the summer, the Baji disappeared, likely heading upstream in other rivers that flowed into the lake to reproduce. Like the hundreds of thousands of field notes sitting silent in museum archives, Hoy's account of his collecting experience tells us facts that we cannot know today. The world has changed since a young hunter happened to shoot a dolphin in an oxbow lake 700 miles from an ocean. The crate containing the plaster-wrapped fossils from Panama arrived at the museum about a year later, following the expected bureaucratic delays that frustrate me and many other scientists with regularity. At the museum, Jorge and I rolled the crate into the vertebrate paleontology preparation lab, where staff skilled in anatomy, manual dexterity, and material properties started the process of exhuming the fossil encased in plaster and rock. Over the course of several months, fast work actually, helped in part by the soft rock, they sawed and ripped the hardened plaster bandages away, and then slowly brushed, scraped, and drilled away sediment layer by layer around the skull. Sometimes their work involves heavy machinery, like a pneumatic saw. Other times, a simple dental pick to scrape away at grains of sand. Here, studio art meets laboratory of extinct anatomy. Glue, of course, is always on hand. Slowly, more and more of the fossil came to light. Jorge and I could see, week by week, the slow reveal of intact bone with skull traits that pointed to a fossil species unlike anything previously reported. I know the disappointment that sets in when a promising fossil turns out to be run-of-the-mill. This was exactly the opposite. Anticipation built as we saw more and more of the delicate, incomplete fossil revealed before our eyes. And we became increasingly sure that it belonged to a species of toothed whale that had been extinct for millions of years. For museum scientists, skulls are far more than trophies. Although they do occasionally have that type of glamour, skulls house organs that control the most important functions in the life of a whale: how it feeds, sees, hears, and thinks. These organs tend to reflect adaptations tailored to a whale's ecology, living in turbid waters, for example. Consequently, skulls tend to bear many of the most distinctive features identifying a species. The Panama skull was fragmentary, too fragile and too ungainly to hold. Using the techniques from Cerro Baena, Jorge and I scanned the Panama skull, which provide the basis for a digital 3D model and then a full-size 3D printout in plastic, which we could examine and manipulate without fear or limitation, although we kept the original on hand in a special cradle for close-up details. The Panama skull's exposure to the tides had eroded much of the brain case and its left side. We were at least in possession of the top of the skull. It looked reminiscent of the Baji when we placed them side by side. Hoy brought the skull and a few other bones from his Baji carcass to the Smithsonian in 1918. Hoy's Baji skull had an irregular golden color, as if it had been carved from wood. Both it and the Panama skull had long snouts and relatively conical, pointed teeth. We were also struck by the similarities, the pedestal-like prominence at the highest point behind the bony openings of the nostrils. On closer inspection, the configuration of bones didn't quite match, and we decided to expand our comparisons to skulls of other river dolphins. The problem that we had contemplated had in fact vexed students of river dolphin osteology for many decades. Are the similarities among riverine dolphin species indicative of shared ancestry or merely convergence in lifestyle? In other words, did they have long snouts because their shared ancestors happened to have long snouts? Or did they evolve similar features over time because of selection? The fact that river dolphins live in rivers on separate continents would seem like an important clue in their evolutionary history. In the mid-20th century, most experts downplayed this fact and maintained that the four different then-living species, the Baji from China, one species from India and adjacent countries, and two species from South America, all belonged in one taxonomic group. This classification implied a shared or common evolutionary origin, effectively asserting that all river dolphins were more closely related to one another than they were to any other species, living or extinct. Generally, the idea held that river dolphins were the cetacean version of a living fossil, so-called archaic species that happened to have survived extinction by persisting in freshwater refuges, having descended from a single, widespread marine ancestor. Long snouts were the result of shared ancestry, not similar ecology, in this view. The evidence from the DNA of the four river dolphin species showed otherwise. They had separate ancestries, and, with the exception of the South American species, which were each other's cousins, they all belonged to different branches on the cetacean family tree. In other words, the world's river dolphins do not form any kind of natural grouping and are mostly unrelated to one another. This molecular finding implied that freshwater lineages colonized each river system on different continents from different ancestors and possibly from different times. Long snouts were the result of selection for snapping up prey in turbid rivers. With this knowledge, we considered our Panamanian specimen. We had collected it from marine rocks along the Caribbean side of the country that were between 6.1 million and 5.8 million years old, well before the rise of the S-shaped isthmus. Its comparatively large eyes, among other more nuanced traits, pointed to its having been a marine inhabitant, like modern oceanic dolphins. This similarity was illusory. Jorge and I discovered, through analysis of its evolutionary relationships with other whales, fossil and modern, that its closest relative is today's Amazon River dolphin, Inia geoffrensis. The new species, which we christened Isminia panamensis, had little to do with Lapodes, of which it was only a distant relative. Instead, Isminia reminded us that features we assumed had evolved for life in the Amazon were also found millions of years earlier in a marine cousin that inhabited the Central American Seaway. From the farthest reaches of the Amazonian watershed, high in the Bolivian and Peruvian Andes, or thousands of miles upstream in the Yangtze River, river dolphins have evolved a specialized way of living that puts them at high risk for extinction should anything about those environments change in an unexpected way. Unlike marine species with broad ranges, which might escape such changes by simply swimming elsewhere, the physical isolation of riverine dolphins means that they have limited options when their local environment suddenly becomes hazardous. They have nowhere else to go. A variety of human activities increases the danger of that dead-end scenario. First, there's wholesale habitat modification, the construction of the Three Gorges Dam, the largest in human history, changed every aspect of the ecosystem in which the Baji had evolved, including its geography, water flow, seasonality, and prey. This scale of all-encompassing change shows how vulnerable any river dolphin is to extinction, especially when you consider the direct ways that humans control waterways, which have inevitably, so far, resulted in more pollution, noise, and bycatch. The corrosive effects of pollution and noise on river dolphin health can be a matter of thresholds and localized concentrations, whereas bycatch is immediately detrimental, the literal, though unintended, removal of a predator from the system. The words we use to describe these dangers sometimes trivialize the magnitude of their impact. Bycatch sounds abstract, almost like an economic variable, but it accounts for the mortality of over 300,000 cetaceans each year, large and small, common and endangered. One of these species endangered by bycatch is a species of porpoise called the vaquita, known to science only since 1958. They are uniquely found in the northern corner of the Gulf of California, Mexico, and nowhere else. They are among the smallest cetacean species, furtive, and extremely difficult to study. You could cradle one across your open arms, although you'd be hard-pressed to. As I write, there are fewer than 30 vaquita left, maybe far fewer if you talk to the scientists who've looked for them. For the past few decades, the vaquita's fate has been tied to the totoaba, a large fish that also uniquely lives in the Gulf. When stretched and dried, a single totoaba swim bladder fetches several thousand dollars on Asian markets, where they are coveted as gifts, dowries, or, more questionably, medicine. An illegal global supply chain, likely linked to criminal enterprise, is clearly responsible for the unabated demand, which has only increased as the totoaba becomes rare itself. In the Gulf, illegal gill nets rake in both vaquita and totoaba indiscriminately. The vaquita is a casualty of market forces, both local and a world away. After several years of ineffective plans to limit the scope of illegal fishing, which most directly threatened the vaquita, the strategy to save the vaquita entered a new phase without precedent. Capture any surviving individuals and transport them to a sea pen, where they could be protected until the threats to their environment could be controlled and mitigated. The scale of the effort was massive, involving over 100 scientists from around the world, including veterinarians, behavioral ecologists, acoustic biologists, and fishery scientists. They used an array of listening devices in the water to detect the notoriously shy porpoises, and in an ambitious and desperate turn, brought in U.S. Navy-trained dolphins, like sheepdogs, to corral the vaquita. Nothing like it had ever been attempted before, because the risks with this type of ex situ conservation were raised by the vaquita itself. When hauled out of the water, even for a brief period of time, it panics, which means the stresses of capture and captivity can lead outright to death. Unfortunately, that's exactly what happened. After the successful capture and release of a calf, a second vaquita, captured by the team, succumbed to the stress of its capture. After deliberation, this outcome led to the suspension of the effort and the grim acknowledgement of the great dilemma with the vaquita. Doing nothing will almost certainly lead to their demise, and capturing any living ones and trying to implement a captive breeding program may only accelerate the same fate. Extinction does have a fixed line in time, set when the last individual of a species dies. But practically, for scientists wanting to measure survivorship for a group of organisms, it becomes more of a probabilistic description. We call a species extinct when we haven't seen it in a very long time. In other words, knowing about extinction is a game of probabilities, not absolutes. Consider any species that has gone extinct in recorded human history. More often than not, it's a story of decline leading to fewer and fewer sightings or captures until it's just silence for many, many years. In the case of whales, their inaccessibility and huge geographic expanse compounds the challenge in making such a firm declaration about their fate. Even for geographically limited whales, river dolphins, or the vaquita, it's fiendishly difficult to arrive at a precise number for a population because it's still not possible to survey every corner and cove of an animal's habitat with either visual or acoustic tools. As a consequence, the status of even the bajie, not seen since 2002, is sometimes qualified as functionally or effectively extinct as a way to grapple with the possibility or hope that we might be wrong. We may never know the last survivor because extinction, especially for animals in the water, happens silently. Most whale species that ever evolved are extinct, the reality of a 50 million year history on Earth. The ultimate reason for their disappearances is imperfectly known. Paleontologists will talk a good game about changing habitats, hyper-specializations, competition, or predation. But the fact is that, lacking a convenient marker such as a mass extinction event, it is hard to point to a transparent explanation. Today, there is no confusion. Human agency, in all its forms, produces the strongest extinction pressure on whales. The fates of the bajie and the vaquita are likely sealed for different reasons, mostly related to their particular histories and human causes. Wholesale habitat modification for the bajie, and fisheries bycatch for the vaquita. While direct hunting from whaling jeopardizes far fewer whales today than it did in the recent past, the indirect pathways of ocean noise, habitat modification, bycatch, and pollution, if unmitigated, represent the primary ways that whale species might go extinct in the near future. There are about half a dozen bajie specimens in the world's museums, including the Smithsonian's type specimen, and 29 specimens of vaquita, accessioned to North American natural history museums. There will be few, if any, additions to these records, which constitute the total material remains of this species that we will ever have. There are whale species for which we have thousands of specimens. There are some whale species, especially belonging to the family of beaked whales, for which our total biological knowledge rests with a single skull in a museum drawer. For the species that are still fundamentally enigmatic in the truest sense of the word, scientists simply do not have enough information to argue, one way or another, about their ability to survive in the oceans during the age of humans. We need to know what exists if we want to have any hope of preserving it. Chapter 16. Evolution in the Anthropocene. On a skiff off the coast of Alaska, in the inner passage of the Alexander Archipelago, I peered through binoculars at a pair of humpbacks. Jan Straley, a biology professor, stood by the outboard motor. We had tagged the whales a few hours earlier, and we now trailed their slow path through the waterways. Every time they surfaced to breathe, we recorded their cartographic bearing and distance. We had eased into a nice pace following the whales. 5 blows apiece at the surface, dive for a few minutes, then surface and repeat. Suddenly, midway through one of the blow sequences, the humpback pair abruptly cut it short, dived, and stayed down. Moments later, I understood why. I caught sight of a tall dorsal fin that can belong only to an adult male killer whale, knifing through the air. From far away, the elongate triangle was devoid of reflection, as if someone had cut a hole out of the sky. The tall fin, maybe 5 feet high, wobbled in its momentary transit out of water, and then slipped back through the mirror. Shorter, more rounded dorsal fins, likely belonging to females and younger whales, followed. They moved quickly, surfacing in succession, heading towards the humpbacks in our boat. The pod of half a dozen or so killer whales did not surface again until they left the sound behind us. A pod of killer whales glides unharried through the ocean because they have no ocean-bound predators. They are the largest species of true oceanic dolphins, and their cunning, curiosity, and other striking behaviors are nearly synonymous with their common epithet, orca. As the supreme predator of the oceans, their diet includes an entire species list of other marine predators. Great white sharks, baleen whales, other dolphins, porpoises, sea lions, salmon, and squid. Killer whales will even pick off the unfortunate land mammal that happens to be paddling in the wrong place at the wrong time, even deer or moose. While humans have hunted and continue to hunt them, only captive killer whales in aquariums have maimed or killed humans. Still, the way the pod moved through the water both surprised and unsettled me. I was happy for the distance between our open boat and the ominous black forms that raced through the sound. An adult male killer whale might weigh as much as 10 tons and reach 30 feet in length, while an adult humpback outweighs a single killer whale by a factor of 4. It's the fact that killer whales hunt together as a group that makes the strategic calculus of fight versus flight more complex. Humpbacks have scalloped flippers, 1/3 their body length, that can be used as weapons in self-defense, the deterrence of a 13-foot-long windmill blade on a spinning 40-ton whale. A pod of killer whales will undoubtedly harass adult humpbacks. Even though they would probably much rather hunt a calf, they can cooperatively kill whales much larger than themselves. Jan caught my surprised face. "Oh, that's fun," she offered casually, the cheerful but measured reaction of someone who's seen a lot of Alaskan natural history. "Those are probably transients," she said, referring to the mammal-eating killer whale ecotype. In the Pacific Northwest, scientists recognize 3 different ecological varieties of killer whales, each genetically and behaviorally distinct. Aside from the mammal-eating one that ranges from Alaska to California, there's a resident group that specializes on salmon runs. Residents are strongly matrilineal and vocalize frequently, whereas transients have pods composed of fluid associations of unrelated individuals that vocalize only after a stealthy hunt for mammal prey that might otherwise hear them coming. A third ecotype, offshore killer whales, are little known, although some studies suggest that they eat sharks. Back in the boat, within a few minutes, the humpbacks resurfaced, showing no outward signs, as far as we could tell, of what had transpired beneath, continuing along their meandering course through the procession of tree-lined islands. Sitka is perched on a narrow toehold of land between rocky coast and snow-capped mountains in southeast Alaska. Today, fewer than 10,000 people live there, but its location on the panhandle of Alaska has long made it a convenient launching point for expeditions, including my predecessors at the Smithsonian, who organized the very first ones. At the time, Alaska was still relatively unknown to Western scientists, having been purchased as an American territory only in 1867. Within a decade, Smithsonian scientists passed through Sitka on their way inland, or out along the Aleutian Island chain. The scientists who traveled throughout Alaska in the 19th century rarely pigeonholed themselves into the professions we now call paleontology, mammalogy, ornithology, and malacology. They were just naturalists, with omnivorous interests, careful eyes, and assiduous collecting habits. Their work begat collections that continue to inform us about American wilderness near the Arctic Circle. Spending time in Sitka, for me, meant walking in their footsteps. I was there for similarly cross-disciplinary reasons, tagging humpback whales and hunting Oligocene rocks that had already produced scrappy but tantalizing fossils nearby. On an off day, Jan and I walked over to the Sitka Sound Science Center, a nonprofit housed in a renovated school. Inside one of the touch tanks hung the skeleton of a young killer whale that had stranded on nearby Kruzoff Island. Kruzoff is a squat, cone-shaped volcanic island that looms quietly in the vista north of town, an inescapable reminder of geologic scale forces that could spring to life at any moment. It took a Coast Guard helicopter to haul the carcass, in segments, off of Kruzoff's black sand beaches. During the later necropsy, a pile of bones, hair, whiskers, and claws was discovered in its stomach, a last meal that likely consisted of a harbor seal. Those stomach contents were sure signs that this animal, about 7 years old at the time of death, based on later studies of tooth rings, was a member of the mammal-eating or transient killer whale ecotype. Whereas killer whales once could readily hunt baleen whales, the large-scale removal of this prey resource in the whaling era meant that they had to compensate by eating other available prey, such as seals and sea otters. In a follow-up to their top-down trophic cascades paper, Jim Estes and his colleagues argued that in fact the loss of large whale biomass following whaling led to a fundamental shift in the diet of marine mammal-eating killer whales in the North Pacific. Jim and his colleagues argued that killer whales progressively ate their way down trophic levels. After large baleen whales were removed, sea lion and seal populations crashed, and then sea otters. Nothing in biology is perfectly clean, especially in ecology at sea, and myriad human impacts likely complicate this simple explanation. Nonetheless, after calculating the caloric needs of killer whales and the energy represented by their prey switching, and scouring the literature for historical data on killer whales attacking baleen whales, Jim and his colleagues found ample evidence to support the idea that killer whale feeding behavior could cause the kind of ecological effects witnessed in marine mammal populations in the North Pacific over the last half of the 20th century. This proposal elicited a lot of debate among marine ecologists because it implied that killer whales, by prey choice alone, could direct strong top-down trophic pressures. Also, the hypothesis relied on events that were difficult to discern. How often did killer whales eat large baleen whales before whaling? How often do killer whales eat sea otters today, even? Ecological interactions, especially for whales, are a matter of careful detective work and inference. Regardless of what they are eating, killer whales hunt cooperatively, analogous to the way that wolves hunt as a pack. A single killer whale, with its heft and large peg-like teeth, should be an unsettling sight for any smaller marine mammal, cetacean or otherwise. But killer whales multiply this effect by coordinating their hunts in pods. Together, multiple individuals can attack a much larger organism, even a blue whale, by biting and using their bodies to keep the whale from surfacing, a much easier tactic when their prey are calves or species the same size or smaller than they are. When their hunts are successful, killer whales will strip meat using their teeth. Without opposable thumbs or hands, they need to work together to pull in opposite directions. They then share food among their pod, like many other mammals. Killer whales also have a reputation for killing seemingly for practice or play. Catapulting apprehended seals dozens of feet in the air with their powerful tails. Behavior that is poorly understood, but nonetheless discomforting to human onlookers. Killer whale pods have strong family ties that make them extremely social animals. Generally, they are matrilineal, with matriarchs retaining the leadership role of the group. In resident ecotypes, matriarchs rule the entire pod, while relationships are less structured in other ecotypes. In the wild, killer whales can live into their 90s, although in captivity, that number tops out at 50 years. There are likely killer whales that live through the entire rise and fall of industrial whaling, witnessing untold changes to the entire food web, both at sea and along the coasts. The chemical history locked inside the teeth and bones of these individual killer whales might say a lot about the top-down versus bottom-up trophic patterns. Living at the top of a food web for decades also means continual exposure to and concentration of persistent poisons in your diet. For the same reasons mercury levels concentrate in seafood like canned tuna, killer whales possess some of the most contaminated tissue of any mammal on the planet, carrying high loads of chemicals such as flame retardants and complex organic molecules, which resist rapid decomposition. Like bowhead whales in the Arctic, killer whale pods are mobile archives of humanity's chemical legacy. For killer whale pods that live close to major urban areas, like the resident killer whale pods that show up in Puget Sound near Seattle, their toxin-laced blubber may be a detriment to their health and reproductive fitness during lean times. Killer whales are built on the same body plan as many of their smaller relatives, oceanic dolphins, such as bottlenose, spinner, or common dolphins, except with fewer and larger teeth, and scaled up several times. When we chart the ratio of brain size to body size, a metric called the encephalization quotient, or EQ, we have a way of quantifying the fact that dolphins are indeed very brainy. While baleen whales and river dolphins plot closer to primates, oceanic dolphins, including killer whales, plot higher than every other mammal except us, slotting in second behind humans, but ahead of chimpanzees. For most of the past 10 million years, a dolphin was the brainiest creature on the planet. The EQ values for our own lineage bumped up beyond the dolphin threshold only in the past few hundred thousand years. In the rare opportunities when it's possible to preserve their brains after death, brain tissue liquefies extremely quickly unless it's stabilized with preservatives, we can see a highly corrugated exterior surface across two bulbous hemispheres, much like our own. That shape and texture of the cerebral cortex is very different from that of, say, a deer, sheep, or cow, which are among the nearest relatives to cetaceans. It's difficult enough to infer function from form in human brains. After all, figuring out how the architecture of 100 billion neurons writes symphonies is one of the great unresolved questions in modern neuroscience. But the deep gyri and sulci on dolphins, which are similar to our own, tells us that there is some anatomical underpinning to the behaviors that appear so sophisticated and intelligent to us. If we share similarly structured brains with killer whales, are there behaviors beyond the facts of their ecology, such as cooperative hunting or family structures lasting decades, that we share as well? For behavioral biologists, mere self-recognition is a coarse way to determine if the viewer has a sense of awareness, which in turn suggests the ability to understand that the animal on the other side of the mirror isn't a random part of its world. The list of mammals that can look into a mirror and recognize their own faces is very short. Us, great apes, Asian elephants, and possibly two kinds of cetaceans, bottlenose dolphins, and maybe killer whales. The test is straightforward in concept. Place a mark on an animal and then determine whether it examines the mark in the mirror. But it is extremely tricky to execute in a controlled experimental setting, especially for an aquatic mammal without opposable thumbs. Bottlenose dolphins in captivity have afforded the best opportunities, whereas experiments with captive killer whales have been more tricky. Regardless of logistics, the best data available show that mirror self-recognition in cetaceans is real. These whales are quite aware that they have lives circumscribed by plain concrete walls, instead of a world as complex and dynamic as an ocean. What we do with that information depends on our response as a social species, our laws, ethics, and economics all playing into the decisions we make about keeping large oceanic predators captive for our own entertainment. If EQ is broadly reflective of some kind of cultural capacity, then it's a fair supposition that cetacean societies have been part of this planet for at least 10 to 100 times longer than our own. How old are some of their traditions and behaviors? What cultural innovations did they have that went extinct? We can read only so much from bones. Maybe we'll figure out how to scratch away at those other questions. One way that we can tackle some of these issues is to examine the complexity of their acoustic lives. The iconic bellowing and rubbery chirps of whale song are just some of many kinds of vocalizations by baleen whales. Some strange and unusual sounds heard in the oceans still haven't been entirely tied to specific species. Only recently have researchers connected a bizarre underwater boing noise heard for decades to minke whales. Toothed whales, such as dolphins, beaked whales, and sperm whales, vocalize at low frequencies too, but also use high-frequency or ultrasonic clicks and pings emitted from their biosonar apparatus to navigate and signal to others around them. It's a bit like an acoustic analog of running around at night using flashlights with your friends. By light alone, you can see where they're going and what they're spotlighting and infer something about their movement. The click trains of echolocating toothed whales are complex and so variable in frequency, power, and organization that the mathematics of information theory seems to be one of the few tractable ways to describe their information content. The fact that whales seem to be having conversations without us hasn't been lost on scientists eager to bridge the divide. This divide, however, is many times greater than that between us and chimpanzees and other great apes. At least we share common body form, ecology, and communication modes. With whales, it has been an immense challenge to interpret the important threads of information they share among themselves. A click train from a sperm whale a mile deep may convey thoughts about where lunch is located or the meaning of the universe. We cannot tell or know the difference because the meaning of their language is lost without knowing the context. All attempts to decipher some kind of language out of the jabber of squeaks, chirps, and rapid taps have failed because whales live in a world that is so foreign to us. There is one last piece to the still unsolved puzzle of whale intelligence, and it fits somewhere between behavior and cognition. Whales possess culture. Let's put aside art and material culture for a moment and focus on the broader definition of culture. Any kind of information stored outside of an animal's DNA that can be transmitted across individuals or generations. That type of definition fits what many species of whales do, as much as chimpanzees and elephants, among other animals besides us. Unsurprisingly, the best available evidence for culture in whales comes from their acoustic behavior, that content-rich but enigmatic repertoire of clicks and echolocating whales' calls. Fish-eating and mammal-eating killer whale ecotypes each possess separate and distinctive acoustic repertoires, cohesive across several matrilineal groups, numbering in the hundreds and ranging over hundreds of miles. Sperm whales, which have distinct acoustic clans, take these linkages of cetacean societies and expand them to the scale of ocean basins, stretching over thousands of individuals and over thousands of miles. They may represent the most far-flung cooperative groups aside from us. Sperm whale clans are made up of multiple smaller long-term social units, akin to pods among orcas. Each clan is tied to multiple matrilines that hang together in multi-generational societies of sperm whale grandmothers, mothers, and daughters, all learning from one another how to hunt squid, raise calves, babysit, and defend against their only predators, killer whales. Adult males live comparatively solitary lives after leaving their natal social units in their teens and are sporadic members of sperm whale societies. Each sperm whale unit shares the same distinctive acoustic dialect, and these dialects form a common basis for interacting at sea. Imagine, for a moment, what whaling might have done to these societies. Losing an entire clan of sperm whales, as rapacious as whaling was, may have meant losing an entire dialect and all of its distinct cultural traditions with it. Given what we know about past effects of humans on whales, which of them now stand the best chance of success in the Anthropocene? Several imperatives give us clues about which whales are likely to be among the winners. First, be just the right size. Almost all the largest whale species today, including blue whales and right whales, are navigating an increasingly urbanized ocean habitat while still struggling to recover from the centuries-long legacy of industrial whaling. Blue, fin, bowhead, and right whales all rank among the largest animals ever to have evolved on the planet, with body weights exceeding 80 tons, reaching well beyond 100 tons for the largest individuals. While these sizes likely evolved out of trade-offs for feeding efficiency and long-range migration, their extreme size today puts them at risk of entanglement in fishing gear and trauma from ship strikes. At the other end, many of the smallest whale species, such as the vaquita and finless porpoises, are in jeopardy of extinction because their body size evolved as a consequence of their geographic isolation. In their case, changes to a single river or embayment can imperil the entirety of their lineage. Most whale species fall in size ranges between those extremes. Their fates are instead tied to other factors, such as diet and geographic range. Second, don't be a picky eater. In an evolutionary view, hyperspecialization allows species to exploit particular lifestyles, habitats, or prey resources. Consider parasites dependent on a single host species, or hummingbirds that feed on the nectar of a specific flower. Should any component of that relationship change, the hyperspecialist may be at an evolutionary dead end. Whales specializing in one specific prey type, even if it is particularly abundant, such as blue whales dependent on krill or killer whale ecotypes eating exclusively salmon, may have little flexibility to adapt to sudden changes in the environment, especially if changes in ocean chemistry and temperature affect their food security. Whales that feed on a variety of prey species, such as humpback or gray whales, will have more flexibility than whales that feed on prey, available only in some places or at certain times. Humpbacks and gray whales also happen to be just the right size, falling in a Goldilocks size category for baleen whales that's not too big and not too small. The rich diversity and enormous abundance of cephalopods in the open ocean comprise a large portion of the diet of toothed whales, such as sperm whales, beaked whales, and oceanic dolphins. Cephalopods show no signs of going away in the Anthropocene, providing at least some measure of food security for these species. Third, stay global. Having a global footprint provides an insurance policy against local or regional calamity, maximizes gene flow, and broadens access to a variety of prey. Sperm whales, killer whales, and humpback whales are all found across the world, even if some regional populations are distinctive. Killer whales, for example, have genetically restricted ecotypes with specific diets. Some humpback populations in the Arabian Sea do not migrate at all. The rest of the lineage is broadly enough distributed around the globe to provide the greatest possible hedge against extinction. Fourth, culture helps. Killer whales, humpbacks, and sperm whales all possess a kind of culture that is woven into their behavior and social structure and provides resilience against unexpected changes as well as the basic ability to innovate in a changing environment. Culture is adaptive, after all. Anthropocene Earth is certainly changing rapidly, and the hazards for cetaceans are myriad and complex across geography and time. Whale species such as river dolphins and the vaquita don't appear to show the same cultural traits that we find in other cetaceans, although we still know so little about the minds of whales that it is presumptuous to apply a harsh rubric on this factor. Last, nothing's perfect. The factors that lead to success or peril in the Anthropocene don't conveniently apply in a clean way across all whale species alive today. For example, blue whales are globally distributed, but they push the maximum size limit for rorqual whales and have a very specialized diet. They're also the target of sustained pressure, eliminating 99% of their biological diversity. They're almost paradoxically awesome. What makes them marvels of efficiency has also made them vulnerable to extinction. Or take killer whales again. They range across the entire globe, have a broad dietary range as a species, and live in large groups with strong social units and culture, all of which provides a vouchsafe against the unpredictable and ongoing changes to their environment. However, their position at the apex of the food chain also makes them susceptible to persistent pollutants that biomagnify and concentrate in their bodies. Killer whales, like blue whales, live at the mercy and curse of human civilization. When I think about the killer whale skeleton hanging in Sitka, I think about how killer whales remain a story of evolution right before our eyes. As a species, their prey diversity is quite large, but the different kinds of ecotypes with their highly specific diets and cultures means that the genetic divergences among these ecologically distinct populations represent the first steps of true lineage splitting, leading to new species of killer whales, despite the fact that they live literally side by side. There seems to be no going back for the mammal, salmon, and shark eaters. Like us, killer whales have big brains and lead complex lives in complex environments, traits that put some of their lineages at risk while simultaneously enabling other lineages to continue to evolve in new ways. Maybe the present for killer whales isn't too different from our own recent evolutionary past, when many big-brained hominids competed for Pleistocene resources. There are, fortunately, many mysteries left for us to uncover as we try to navigate the open waters between our two cultures, cetacean and human. Chapter 17, Whalebone Junction. The low light of a fall afternoon stretched the shadows as we made our way across the Outer Banks of North Carolina. Out the car window, I scanned the dunes and the windblown oak scrubland. My wife and son gazed out, lost in thought, while the toddler slept, her cheeks still and chest lifting in quiet pace. I turned off the state road, easing the car to a stop that interrupted everyone's daydreaming. "Okay, we're here," I announced. "This isn't a park," my son declared after glancing out the window. "You said there would be a park with swings." My wife winced as she looked at me. "I know," I said. "I'll tell you what, I just need a few minutes. Then we'll go find that park. Or climb to the top of the Bodie Island lighthouse. We haven't done that one yet," I offered. We tried to visit every lighthouse that we could along the coast. My son is fearless of heights, in the way that children can sometimes be so different from their parents. He moaned. "I'll be fast," I said, not sure that I could back that up. "But we're not carrying specimens for the National Museum this time, so you don't have to stay and guard them. You can come in with me if you want." I smiled at my own little joke, which no one else found funny. "The things you ask your family to do when you're a paleontologist." I walked out to the small hut of a ranger station, where a brightly painted sign read, "Whalebone Junction, This spot at the northern gate to the Cape Hatteras National Seashore had earned its name from a whale skeleton that had once been mounted in front of a gas station decades ago. It stood as a waypoint between the road heading north to Kitty Hawk and a turn east across a bridge to the mainland. Today, both the skeleton and the gas station are long gone. The name, of course, piqued my interest, but for a reason that had more to do with deep time than the last few decades. It's not always clear if whale bones on a beach in this part of the world belong to a living species. It's possible they belong to completely extinct ones, occasionally roughed out of fossil-rich rocks in rock layers underwater, just yards away from the beach. These bones can be relics from the ice ages or many more millions of years further back in geologic time. You just never know. I thought that chatting up a local might yield more than I could scrounge on the internet. Inside, the volunteer offered little beyond vague recollections and an internet search or two on the computer at hand. Bemused, I thanked him and returned to the car. "See?" I boasted when I returned. My family was unimpressed. "Lucy's awake," my son intoned matter-of-factly. "I think it might be ice cream time before we go to the lighthouse," my wife announced, looking to the back of the car. "Sounds about right to me, too," I said. I thought of the one historical black-and-white image that I had seen of the whale at Whalebone Junction, maybe from the 1950s. It showed several children leaning against a sad excuse for a skeletal mount, a broken skull tilted against a string of vertebrae, with a jawbone slid underneath in a comically incorrect pose. The skeleton probably belonged to a humpback whale, a sei whale, or another mid-sized species of rorqual. But the reason why I'd followed this thread more than the usual loose threads was the hope that it might have been a gray whale, a species closely related to rorquals, but lacking the flexible throat pouch and titanic size classes. The Outer Banks is the wrong place to chase living gray whales today, because there are none to be found. It is, however, a place to chase their past and their future. Today, gray whales are among the most abundant whale species in the North Pacific Ocean. True to their name, their skin is the color of gunmetal, underlying a patchwork of mottled white and yellow splotches. Their snout is more beak-like than that of any baleen whale, and the rest of their body outline a bit unremarkable, except for a knuckled tail stalk. They swim slowly, and unlike most baleen whales, they mostly hew close to the shoreline, where sharp-eyed whale watchers can spot them from atop seaside overlooks, or certainly their uniquely puffy, heart-shaped blows. The most recent surveys place their total numbers at some 20,000, unevenly distributed across two populations along the western and eastern coasts of the North Pacific Basin, stretching from the Korean Peninsula to Baja California. Nearly every gray whale alive today belongs to the so-called California or eastern population. Western gray whales, which live mostly in the Sea of Okhotsk off Russia, number perhaps no more than 100 and remain poorly studied. As a consequence of their lifestyle and abundance, gray whales are also iconic whales of the North Pacific. Like cave paintings for the modern world, their life-size likenesses grace murals on parking garages and downtown business centers from San Diego to British Columbia. Their lore has a lot to do with the fact that the eastern population undertakes one of the longest migrations of any mammal on the planet, after overwintering in lagoons along the Pacific side of Baja California. They migrate with newborn calves to feed on the shallow seafloors of the Bering and Chukchi seas during the bountiful summer. Then, as summer turns to fall, they return from Alaska to Baja, completing an approximately 10,000-mile round trip. Small towns from Sitka to Monterey time festivals to celebrate their passage within eye and earshot with the requisite T-shirts and tchotchkes. Gray whales seek the shallow seafloors off Alaska because these habitats are hugely productive, harboring an incredible abundance of crustaceans. During the summer months, increased sunlight jumpstarts the amount of energy entering this marine ecosystem, which produces enough biomass to support millions of seabirds, walruses, halibut, and whales. Gray whales are unusual among baleen whales in having an especially broad diet, and they have a similarly flexible feeding style. Like a vacuum, they can suck and filter carpets of soft seafloor loaded with invertebrate prey. Or they can chase and gulp swarms, even schools of fish, in the water column. The feeding trails left on the seafloor by gray whales are wide, long, and in high enough density to completely restructure it, which has led some scientists to describe gray whales as ecosystem engineers. By stirring up sediment and leaving a wake of suspended organisms, they create the food webs for other smaller animals in the Bering and Chukchi seas to consume. Their coastal preference, however, also nearly became their undoing. Charles M. Scammon, a mid-19th century whaling captain with the keen eye of a naturalist, published the first observations of living gray whales when his crews discovered their breeding grounds in Baja California. Within decades, gray whale numbers plummeted as they became easy targets for whalers in the North Pacific. By the end of the 19th century, it wasn't even clear if any gray whales still survived. As gray whales continued to be killed into the 20th century, the IWC eventually implemented a commercial whaling ban on this species in 1946. Over the course of the ensuing decades, well through the peak of Southern Ocean whaling and illegal Soviet whaling in the North Pacific, gray whales managed to recover. In 1994, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, officially delisted gray whales from their endangered status under the U.S. Endangered Species Act, recognizing their recovery from the brink of extinction in less than 100 years. Since their delisting, gray whales' population has mostly stayed constant, and they're frequently touted as a conservation success story, in marked contrast to other species of large baleen whales, which were decimated over the same time period. Protection from whaling is likely what gave the species breathing room, letting their biology do the rest. But really understanding gray whales and their potential future requires stepping much further back in time and looking to horizons beyond the North Pacific. My colleague Scott Noakes is a scientific diver by profession, and what I do on land, he does underwater, many miles offshore. He collects bones, but he does it from the seafloor. He uses a hose instead of a rock pick to blow sediment away, and dive flippers instead of boots. We both share limitations of access, but where timing is concerned, I might worry about losing fossils to the tides. He has to worry about running out of oxygen. Bones belonging to large, extinct mammals are not uncommon finds in the waterways and underwater coastlines of the southeastern United States. But instead of finding fragments of Ice Age mammoths or camels off the coast of Georgia, Scott finds whale bones. Each episode of sea level rise and fall over the past few million years has created unique reefs along the coast, today located in places that are too deep and too cold to support corals. Clearly, whales once lived and died nearby. Scott and his colleagues found jawbones belonging to not one, but two different individual gray whales, both young animals, based on their length. In all likelihood, this part of the world was once part of the migration path for Atlantic gray whales, if not very close to their calving grounds during the ice ages. Advanced dating techniques place the two sets of bones at about 41,000 and 48,000 years old, well into the last glacial interval. Scott's gray whale bones are the oldest of any found over the past few decades along eastern shores of the United States, from Myrtle Beach and the Outer Banks in the Carolinas, through New Jersey to Long Island. Gray whale bones have been discovered as far away as England and Sweden, showing a range of occupation across the North Atlantic, not unlike that of their counterparts across the North Pacific today. Radiocarbon ages extracted from some of these bones, including specimens stored at the Smithsonian, provide a clear chronology for gray whales since the last glacial episode of the Ice Ages up until about 450 years ago. This time frame ends well before the 19th century heyday of American whaling. So when and why did Atlantic gray whales go extinct? Until we find more fossils or more recent bones with DNA, we won't know more about this ghost lineage of gray whales. If gray whales